Hey everyone, this is Harmon. Welcome to Comedy History 101, where we school you in comedy. Now, to bookend the pandemic, we have a very special reprise of an episode that we did right at the start of the pandemic on the history of comedy after 9/11. Yes, how we rebounded with humor from a horrific tragedy. And now once again, we are rebounding after a horrific tragedy. But before we jump into the episode, a quick plug. Tonight, June 18th, 7 p.m. at the Red Room in New York City, I will be presenting my show, Tale, New York City's Finest Storytelling. If you are in the NYC, come on down to the Red Room above the KGB bar. Also, take some time to like, subscribe, and comment on Comedy History 101, wherever you might get your podcast, or on our website, comedyhistory101.com. And now, without further ado,
good thing about doing comedy in Russia, you have captured audience.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Comedy History 101.
That's the way my mind works. I wanted to basically address the elephant in the room.
I have to catch a flight to California. I can't get a direct flight. They said they have to stop at the Empire State Building first.
Too soon, dude.
So what you heard there was a clip of Gilbert Gottfried from the 2001 Friars Club roast of Hugh Hefner. And yes, you've tuned into another episode of
Comedy History 101,
where we school you in comedy. I am a quarantine Harmon Leon. With me is a still quarantine Scott Colonico. Scott, a quarantine top of the morning to you.
And a quarantine Guten Morgen to you, Harmon, from here in Berlin.
Yeah. So how is the pandemic self-isolation going in Berlin?
Here's okay. They kind of opened some stores back up again. I did wear my mask. You have to wear a mask now if you go into the store or take the U-Bahn or the subway.
Oh, dude, so, I'm going to sound like a guy that listened to like an indie band before they became famous on you.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, please, you have to wear masks. I remember weeks ago when we had to officially wear masks and going into establishments.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was brought down by our Governor Cuomo.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, this is like now they're saying, you know, you have to wear it, which is weird after all this time.
So, Scott, what we are currently facing is a global crisis, and the clip we heard up front was from 2001 from the Comedy Central roast, which was originally a Friars Club roast, of Hugh Hefner with Gilbert Gottfried making a joke about another crisis, which brings us to our topic today on Comedy History 101, is comedy after 9/11.
Yeah.
Yeah, God, why are we, like...
Yeah, why are we doing it, dude?
We're in a downer era, and we have sort of a downer type of episode. Why can't we do the history of puppies funny on the internet? So, Scott,
we should do the history of kittens.
The cuteness of kittens on the internet. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Scott, what was 9/11?
Do you want me to go into the geopolitical ramifications of it or just
kind of? No, I want you to go into the loose change conspiracy theory behind it. Scott, in brief, maybe just do the elevator pitch. What is 9/11?
Okay.
What was
9/11? Guys, terrorists.
This is an elevator pitch.
Okay, elevator pitch. Terrorists flew planes into buildings.
That's right. Buildings. And then what did they say about comedy after 9/11?
Well, people were thinking, where does the place of comedy? But more on top of that, people were referring to it as the death of irony.
Yeah, most particularly Roger Rosenblatt wrote a kind of a pinnacle article at the time in Time magazine stating that after 9/11, it was the death of irony. Now, could you go in a little bit into that, what he meant by that? I think I understand his gist, but a lot of people jumped on his bandwagon thinking that, you know, there wasn't going to be comedy after 9/11, which, you know, first of all, it's ridiculous because first, you know, laughter is the best medicine for healing any kind of tragedy. Yeah. So therefore, you know, as we've stated on previous episodes on our history of gallows humor, you know, humor is part of the healing process. But this Roger Rosenblatt, which, you know, he seemed to get a lot of press on this, he declared that it was the death of irony. And just go a little bit into that. What's your take on what the death of irony meant?
He was just suggesting that, you know, people who are like cynical about, you know, America and American beliefs needed to like kind of replace that with a newfound dedication to their country, a little bit more patriotic. That was really kind of the thing. People were looking forward to the death of irony and the death of cynicism.
Yeah. So what he was saying is that you know, beliefs of like, back in the day, the ironists would say, you know, America is the greatest country in the world. And they would say it like ironically, or wear like an ironic American flag t-shirt. All that was like out the window because, you know, people had to come back and say, you know, there was like American flags everywhere, basically, after 9/11. So was his sort of thesis statement saying, you know, all that's out the window because it's no longer ironic? To be ironic about, you know, saying America's the greatest country in the world?
That's what I got out of that.
Okay, so was Rosenblatt wrong? Did irony die? Is that that it?
I think he
has
think
there been
he was,
irony
he was,
since
he was definitely wrong.
Yeah,
he was definitely wrong. But yeah, it was just such a shocking event. I think it was more. Just the way it was so staged, and it was just such a spectacularly staged event by the enemies of freedom that, you know, it just left a mark on anybody who saw it.
So what happened? So what happened like the weeks after, you know, what happened with, you know, much like we have here, because I think what we're going to do in this episode is create some parallels to this modern conundrum which we're in. You know, again, like say in modern era, to bring it all back, because we always say, why this story now? You know, currently, you know, they shut down all the late night TV shows. And in our era, our death of irony is, you know, all the shows basically turned into kind of like small town home public access TV shows where they're all filmed out of, you know, the host's home now.
I know. But, and I think that's kind of interesting now, because now you can you kind of see some of these some of the comedy without the audience laughing at everything. And then you're like, this isn't really that funny.
Yeah. I mean, I think one that was really visible was Bill Maher a bit on his interviews. Do you watch the Bill Maher?
No, I don't.
Yeah, I like Bill Maher, but without the audience, you know, he plays it up to the crowd, you know, when he says a statement and he gets like a big applause break, you know. Uh-huh. So with the statements without the applause breaks, which what's that called when people don't laugh but they clap? It's like clapture or something. You know, it's sort of like when you say a joke that doesn't get a laugh but it gets applause, you know.
Oh, polite. What, golf clapping?
No, just kind of like you're just you know,
Pavlovian response.
Well, you're feeding me to you've already won over the audience, and you're clapture, I think they call it like that. Okay. Someone from SNL, but you know, without that filter, you know, you can see a lot of holes. But you know, I guess it's like an interesting era in late night right now, because it's you know, again, things aren't going to be the same afterwards, and
no.
I think like a lot of these TV execs are going to go,
yeah, our ratings were kind of the same. Can you guys just keep filming these shows out of your homes? I think there's going to be a bit of that with kind of the lesser shows, you know? They're going to realize...
I think so, yep.
that, you know, kind of like on a, you know, you and I do a show called Jokey-Okey, which people can watch every other Thursday night. But, you know, on a setup pretty much similar to that, right now, they're doing late night TV shows.
Yeah. So, but they're dealing, like, well, I mean, well, to go back to the 9/11, I mean, even with the what's going on now, 9/11 things actually stopped. I mean, like, everything, they just pulled the plug on everything for a couple days. I mean, it wasn't, because I know David Letterman was the first late night comic who just got back on the air afterwards.
Yeah, he came, like, the Monday after the attacks.
Okay, yeah, okay. So it was, so those attacks were on a Tuesday. Yeah, so that's almost, that's not even a week later.
That
yeah.
night? I remember that night, and I remember not wanting to go back, not feeling ready to go back, but knowing we had to go back. And, you know, my concerns were minimal compared to people who really suffered. But I felt like Rudy Giuliani kept saying, go back to work, people, not to me, but generally.
Sure.
We got to live our lives, and we have to go back to work, and we can't this and that and this and that and this and that. And so I was trepidatious about it because I didn't know what to say, didn't know what to do. But I knew.
Yeah, and then Conan O'Brien followed the next night, and then Jon Stewart's Daily Show followed just a few nights later.
Yeah, so they were all back out, and they all just kind of, it was a lot of, the hosts came out and kind of gave a tearful monologue, and just they were choked up. You could tell it was definitely a very emotional moment because all of those were in New York.
Yeah, they're all New York City based shows. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and I think Jon Stewart kind of lived close to where you know, the World Trade Center was.
Mm-hmm.
So he lived, you know, close to the financial district. So. You know, again, it was like the thing. So Letterman, what was the first Letterman show like?
Like the first one?
When he came back.
Oh, okay.
Not the first one, the original one where Bill Murray was the guest star. No.
He just kind of came out. If we'd use a direct quote here, he's just like, he said to the audience, if we're going to continue to do shows, I just need to hear myself talk for a few minutes. And so he asked for the audience patience for indulging his monologue. And then basically the quote that people kind of pulled out of this or remembered about this was that how difficult it was going to be doing a TV show that makes fun of everything.
Yeah, I mean, again, it was like, you know, especially with, say, The Daily Show, which was all about, you know, making fun of George Bush at the time and American politics, you know, what is your so-called target?
Right, yeah, exactly.
But with, you know, Letterman, that's more just kind of a mainstream talk show. So I believe he said, you know, he just wanted to hear himself talk for a few minutes, you know, to get it out of his system. And this is dated. He gave praise to Rudy Giuliani.
That's
being the personification of courage. Oh, how times have changed. God. Giuliani could have retired, you know, and he would have a place in history as, you know, somewhat of a hero. But then he just kind of continued being Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah, and then dressing in drag and hanging out with Trump. But the he appeared, like, all the late night talk shows hosts were praising him. Even he appeared on SNL as well too, like right after the attacks.
The mayor spoke. It was a very powerful night.
Yeah, that was like the opening of SNL. They had him come out, and then Lorne Michaels said to Rudy Giuliani, can we be funny again? And I think Giuliani's written quip was, it's you know, hasn't stopped you before, or something like
that. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, that was interesting. Apparently, Lorne Michaels himself came up with that little bit.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pie, people, influences, and experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, and in the case of Letterman, again, you got it after, you know, he kind of gave a heartfelt speech. He twisted it with going, thank God Regis is here, so we have something to make fun of.
And television, as we knew it, was shut down. It was all about the news. And over again, we would live through this horrible phase of our lives. And then one day you called me about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and you said, I'm going back on the air. I'd like you to join me. I was very flattered. And sure enough, you went back. You remember that?
Yeah. So he's got he ended it with a famous return to the Regis Philbin jokes.
Yeah, and then like you said, Jon Stewart. I think at the point, you know, so you already had Letterman, you know, give his heartfelt speech. You had Conan, you know, just saying this is like the hardest thing I've ever done. You know, having to open the show after 9/11. And by that time, like Jon Stewart, I think, you know, a number of other shows, there was like kind of the, Stewart pointed out the cliche nature of another entertainment show beginning with an overwrought speech of a shaken host. Mm-hmm. So he kind of, which is ironic. So they said death of irony. He was already.
But it's already, people were already being ironic. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I liked his joke about being they said get back to work and there were no jobs available for a man in the fetal position under his desk crying, you know. So that's kind of putting it all in a nutshell right there.
Yeah, who else was, do you know any, who else were the guests on Letterman? I mean, I think Regis was, and I don't know, I'm sure they didn't have a stand up. That would have been a tough gig.
That would have been tough gig, tough crowd.
Yeah, but what I'm reading here, it says, like, both Stewart and Letterman exposed the depth of their genuine investment in the patriotic ideas of a democratic society, usually the target of their ridicule and source of their punchlines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I guess goes back to the death of irony kind of statement, you know? Because, like, it showed, like, deep down that they were kind of believing in the patriotic American ideal, you know, values.
Yeah, I mean, it was just people were trying to compare that to Pearl Harbor, or they were comparing it to Pearl Harbor and saying, okay, now is the time that we all have to pull together. You know, we have to face the common enemy. So we don't have time to be making fun of the president or the mayor of New York City or any kind of authority figures.
So Scott, you're a bit of a historian. In fact, you co-host a podcast called "This Is the President." Do yes. you have any reference point to what comedy was like after the JFK assassination?
That's actually very interesting, Harmon, because we'll be doing an episode on this very soon. Yeah, there's a gentleman by the name of Vaughn Meader, who was a young comedian. He was just in his 20s, and this is in 1963, he kind of rose to fame by he had a JFK impersonation that he would do, and he started out doing it in nightclubs, and eventually he started getting, you know, invited on to TV shows and stuff.
Right.
And Steve Allen, all the big guys, Andy Williams show, saw a clip of him on there, and his JFK impression was actually pretty good. And then he would kind of take it a step further, but he would just play JFK as a character and have people in the audience ask him questions like he was at a news conference.
It was like an improv,
but then he put out a record with some other comedians called The First Family, where there were just kind of a lot of skits about, you know,
I think I've seen that at the Smithsonian.
If you were a vinyl collector, if you ever went to any, if you've been into any record store,
that would be there.
You've seen this record.
But no, I can almost picture the cover because I have seen the album cover. Yeah,
because here's the crazy thing. Well, because he kind of looked like JFK a little bit, and like I said, the impression was pretty good, you know. And so when you just hear him on the record, you're just like, oh, that's all right. But the thing is, that was the to that date, that was the fastest selling album in history in the United States. Yeah,
you it was more than say the Beatles or
everything. This is 1963. So this is right before the Beatles happened, right? And so the guy just like, you know, became famous overnight. We'll talk more about this in the podcast. This is the president. But I dug up a couple of White House memos where people at the White House were starting to get a little afraid because Von Meter would go on radio doing his JFK impression going, hey, listen, tune in to W2B2, you know, tomorrow. And the press secretary, Pierre Salinger, is writing these memos going, this guy can't do that, you know, he's impersonating you and stuff. So, apparently Kennedy liked the impression, but it all came to a crashing halt for him. For Mr. Meter after November 22nd. Yeah, just like the album was, nobody wanted to have anything to do with that album anymore. His career just like tanked. He was just about to have a deal.
Did he go back to school and become Dr. Meter?
No,
like Yakov Smirnoff in the fall.
He was
Berlin Wall?
About to have an album came out. Like, the album, like he got, I think it was Columbia. It was one of the big record companies, and they were about to put it out. And then September 11th, or not September. And then JFK was assassinated, and he just kind of disappeared. Kind of moved back to his hometown in Maine, and kind of became the town drunk, more or less. The town friendly drunk. Apparently, he was a friendly drunk. Everybody says.
Though drunk. Wow, that's a movie in the making, in a way, you know? There you go. Yeah, that's interesting. And again, in our Yakov Smirnoff episode, these people with a one-shtick comedy thing. You know, unless they reinvent themselves, that's it. How many Kramer from Seinfeld impersonators were making a decent living up until a point?
Oh, my God. We strayed off the track a little bit there.
I think a little bit, but sort of to get back on. So Will Ferrell said the week of 9/11, he told WNYC, he said the week after 9/11 at SNL, they would have to keep, they said, we have to keep our foot off the gas pedal for a while when it came to politics and topical humor, which they were known for. But it was... only until October, though, when Ferrell was back doing George W. Bush impersonations.
Saturday Night Live, normally seen at this time, will be delayed so that we may bring you the following address from the President of the United States.
Good evening. When I campaigned to be your president, I promised that if elected, I would change the tone in Washington. That I would end the usual partisan bickering and reach out to my opponents, often with a helping hand. And lately, it seems to me that no one has needed a helping hand more than former President Bill Clinton.
Yeah, so it didn't last too long, you know, for him to take his foot off the gas. You know, I think it was just because a lot of people hadn't seen, like, any kind of event like that in their lifetimes, so... we didn't know quite how to react. Kind of like what's going on now, where, you know, what's happening now has happened before throughout history, you know?
Right.
It's just, this is like we're having to live through it, you know? This is the same exact thing happened 100 years ago.
You mean the Spanish flu, sort of thing?
Spanish flu, yep. The Spanish influenza.
Yeah, but there was no internet in the Spanish flu.
Yeah, that's the problem. There was no internet and... another video you can go see on our This Is the President channel. The president in charge at the time, Woodrow Wilson, our favorite racist president. There is nothing in the written record of him ever saying anything about the flu in public. Like, well, imagine something,
yeah,
something like this happening, and the president not even say, as bad as Trump is, like, mm-hmm, this guy didn't say anything about it.
Well, here's two things. So Bill Maher was making the case that, you know, it was okay to say, call it the Chinese flu, because it is like we called it the Spanish flu, uh-huh, at one point. But look who was president when you're calling it the Spanish flu. It was Woodrow, yeah, Wilson, our most... are either most racist president or second most racist president, depending, yeah, on how you want to look at our current, you know, leader of our country. Yeah. But also, though, that's specific. So, all right, so you have that point. But then he went, you know, we had the Hong Kong flu and, you know, all that. But yeah, but that's pointing to cities where you could call it the Wuhan flu. That's different than calling it the Chinese flu. And, yeah, just really cynically saying it like Trump does, you know, that's pointing to, you know, a whole entire country where Hong Kong flu, it's like, all right, I'm racist against Hong Kong people.
Yeah, but do you know why? Do you know why they called it the Spanish flu?
I think it was something about, there was some sort of media, there was something about the media coverage of it or something like that.
Yeah. That's what it was. So,
what explain it a little bit more, because I heard
basically
the explanation
they think it might even have originated in the States, like Kansas in particular. But basically, mm-hmm, what was going on was, you know World War I was happening at the time, so the president Wilson was shipping all these troops, you know, who were going over to France,
right,
and they were getting sick and they were dying before they were even getting to France. And then when they get to France, they infect people. And then they came back from the war, they infect people in the States. And so all the American papers kind of had this, and the French newspapers had, like, they didn't want to talk about the epidemic or anything. So the first, right, news of the epidemic started surfacing in the Spanish newspapers.
Ah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just, bummer trivia, more people died of the Spanish flu in World War I than casualties of World War I.
Yes, exactly. Yep.
So let's bring back a downer with,
yeah,
another
let's
downer.
Keep going down.
on the SNL Welcome Back episode, Reese Witherspoon was mm-hmm, the host of the episode, which, you know, kind of all American. Singer Paul Simon, he did a mournful rendition of his song, The Boxer. Another downer trivia involving SNL and a connection to 9/11. Pete Davidson's dad was a first responder who died in 9/11. So
yeah,
when Pete Davidson was 7 years old. So you, again, there's another connection to SNL. So Scott, what brought irony back? What comedically brought us back? As part of the first steps of the healing process after 9/11?
Well, I would say, you know, on the subject of SNL, I would say when Will Ferrell did his skit about the company Flag Day on SNL, as I mentioned, and where, uh-huh, he's wearing the American flag thong.
Still, you gotta admit, this is one fantastically handsome bulge, huh?
So that kind of was, it's kind of a classic moment. And a little bit of trivia, so I don't know if this is true or not, but apparently in the skit, he's supposed to just be wearing a pair of Daisy Dukes.
Yep.
But if you haven't seen the skit, it's just basically these people, you, yeah, try, after 9/11, in a company, like, being very straight-laced and trying to discuss what to do, and Will Ferrell comes in wearing an American flag thong and just kind of dances around the table and stuff. So, but apparently he put that on right before they broadcast live. Yeah, so they didn't,
nice,
know he was going to be wearing the thong.
And that was on the episode, the first episode back, or?
It was on the 2001 episode. I will come, mm-hmm, back and get the exact date on that. Yeah. Actually, a lot of people here are saying that Will Ferrell's balls healed the country.
And speaking of almost ball shape, another thing that kind of healed the country humorly when after 9/11 was The Onion.
Oh yeah, because that was they were kind of afraid about when they did that issue.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, okay, so on September, it was September 26, 2001, The Onion came out with the issue with the headlines, "Holy fucking shit, attack on America." So, yeah, as the publication editor said, they wanted to avoid cries of too soon by poking fun, gentle fun at our own sincere efforts to make ourselves and each other feel better after 9/11. And they had articles with titles like "Not Knowing What Else to Do," "Women Bakes American Flag Cake." Okay.
Yeah.
I can see that in an Onion sort of pictorial. Oh, okay. Should we just go through a few of these Onion sort of articles?
Yeah, the headline was...
Hijackers surprised to find themselves in hell?
Oh, yeah. Oh my God. Okay. So to follow up on the Will Ferrell thing, man, so that was actually... So him doing the... This is October 6, 2001.
Okay, less than a month.
Sean William Scott. Yeah, so yeah, less than a month. You've got
excuse me. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Also, that's the same show where he did Bush for the first time.
Yeah. So that was sort of like a return to normalcy when you can once again make fun of inept Bush.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And originally on that episode, Ben Stiller was supposed to host. But he pulled out because he was promoting Zoolander at the time, but then he pulled out.
Oh, and that's another thing about Zoolander. They digitally removed the Twin Towers from the opening shot of the movie. Because that was like coming out that week. And so the first shot you see is like a skyline of New York. not good. Here's what they said about the first post 9/11 issue of The Onion. Pulled no punches, causing the staff to worry. They thought it would be the last issue to print. Their targets included hack Hollywood producers, such with the title of the articles, "American Life Turned Into Bad Jerry Bruckheimer Movie."
Yeah, that was a banner headline. I remember that. That was actually pretty funny.
Yeah. So, and they also articles that about reactive xenophobia, which title "Arab American third grader returns from recess crying, saying he didn't kill anyone."
Yeah, there was another one about hijackers surprised to find themselves in hell. They thought they were going to get their 72 versions.
Yeah, so according to writer John Creason, who was a writer at the time, he said, "It wasn't an especially funny issue. In fact, I'd say it was the least funny issue we've ever done. However, since it marked an important step in the country, it learned to laugh, not just after the attacks, but about themselves." But Scott, up front, we played the clip, I think, that really kind of swung the floodgate. Wait, hold on, there's a car coming by. That swung the kind of humor, it's okay to laugh at ourselves, floodgates open. What happened when Gilbert Gottfried was on the Friars Club roast after 9/11?
Well, Harmon, I think... Harmon, let me be frank with you. So Gilbert Gottfried likes to be...
edgy?
Comedian. Yeah, he travels on the edge. He actually prides himself on that. He always wants to be the first to do a joke about an event. And I believe he even said it so himself. He wanted to be the first person to start to tell a 9/11 joke. And there might be ones who told her earlier, but this is a pretty big event, so I guess we'll give him that title for now. Unless one of our listeners can come forward with something else, but he went up on the stage at the Friars Club and said, "I have to leave early tonight. I have to fly to L.A. I couldn't get a direct flight. We had to stop at the Empire State Building."
And how did that go over with the crowd?
Like a lead balloon, Harmon. Didn't go over well. The audience. A smattering of applause, some boos, a couple of too soons, and then what Mr. Gottfried did was follow it up with the famous Aristocrats joke.
Which made it in the movie, The Aristocrats, which was directed by our friend Paul Provenza.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I think, again, I think what we're talking about here is, and just kind of the essence of laughter, which stems to Sigmund Freud's theories on laughter and why we laugh, is like you're bringing out a repressed thought and you're saying, you know, what we fear to say, and thus why, you know, making a 9/11 joke right after 9/11 would get some sort of laugh, because it's like that's kind of like what is repressed in us. You're saying the unsaid, and that, in a sense, is one of the theories why, you know, it's cathartic to elicit a laugh.
Yeah, no, it was good. So I think the death of irony was an early pronouncement that turned out to be wrong. I think, you know, as we can see from it only took a few days for late night talk shows hosts to get back on, and then, as we said, within less than a month, you know, Will Ferrell's back on there doing his Bush impression and walking around with an American flag thong.
Yeah, so again, I think it was somewhere on that WNYC podcast I heard where Will Ferrell was featured. I think also Jeff Ross, you know, who hosts a lot of the comedy roast. You know, yeah. He thought, you know, he heard, you know, all the things like comedy's dead, there's no more comedy. But, you know, within a few days after the attacks, you know, he was, you know, back at the Comedy Cellar in New York. It's like, you know, business not as usual, but, you know, it's just kind of like, I think, you know, comedy took a pause, you know, as it should. But, you know, you can't, as long as there's tragedy fuels comedy. So
yeah,
that's again, we went into that into our episode on the history of gallows humor. So, Scott, I think, you know, to close out this episode,
whoa.
Yeah, Harmon, you got something?
You're not even doing your research, buddy.
All right, go ahead.
So I heard this on a Joe Rogan podcast and just kind of wanted to make sure we talked about it. Was that, yeah? So one of, we haven't covered him yet. I'm sure we'll get to him in his very own episode. One of our favorite comedians, George Carlin, was taping one of his comedy specials on September 10th.
Oh God!
And apparently it was, if you know George Carlin, you know, he's a little jaded, edgy, a little bitter, but he edgy, but he does it in a funny way, and he kind of like makes people think. But apparently this one show was very edgy, very kind of you know, anti-authoritarian, and very kind of Carlin-esque, you know, to the extent that when 9/11 happened, the record company was like, yeah, we're never going to put this out.
Oh, wow. Did it ever get released in it some is. Sort of
it,
form?
So apparently you can get it on Amazon. Amazon, you can download the MP3 or whatever.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. But where do you think, you know, so comedy, so I guess two parts of our conclusion here. How do you think comedy was changed after 9/11? What changed the style of humor? Other than a momentary pause where people were kind of a little bit hesitant on skewing kind of like, you know, authoritarian, you know, people in power. But that, you know, only changed, you know, people were back, you know, doing Bush jokes, you know.
That's what I mean. Because
he was the guy that got us, you know, took us into war.
Yeah, and here's the interesting thing. Hey, you know what, Harmon? We're still at war. So it's who has the last laugh in the end? Not to be laughing at things like that, but yeah, we're still at war in Afghanistan. But I don't think it changed anything really. I think you said what I was going to say. Comedy took a pause, and then everybody was back to business.
Yeah, so, okay, why this story now? How do you think comedy will change once, you know, comedians can go back to the live theater venues and the comedy clubs?
I
do believe there's going to be a shift in the style of comedy.
I don't know about that. I mean,
I think it'll be an era where people want to hear just more sincerity, you know, from comedians, you know, just kind of like we've all kind of like a phony facade has been lifted from people that, it's more of a shared common, it's like everyone's been quarantined, everyone's been isolated. So that's a common thread that's run through everyone where you can't be a character acting like you're crushing it, There's going to be more of a vulnerability in comedy. That's just my prediction when we get back to the clubs around 2025.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing. That's going to be when we get back to the clubs around 2025. And then I think it'll be the same thing. It'll be, people might be doing that for a little bit, but then they'll get back to, they'll be the Andrew Dice Clay of 2026,
You mean, they'll do in 1989 humor?
Yeah.
So that's going to come back? 1989 humor is the
prediction? Like characters and stuff, and it's going to be just what it was before. I mean, there might be a little let up when
I think there'll be a change. I think what the big difference is, you're preventing people, and there is, everyone's doing the live stream shows, so there is an outlet where people are doing comedy. And they're doing a lot of comedy, but they're just doing it minus a live audience. And in some cases, you're doing comedy minus hearing laughter from your audience.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to greatly change how comedy is done. It's just because you have isolated, you put people in a petri dish science experiment of removing the comedy club from the formula. And, I think, depending on how long it goes on, that's going to really change the face of live comedy when that comes back into being. Again, it's just my take.
Yeah, I mean, and you're welcome to your take. I mean, I don't think anything's going to change, really.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's be Roger and Ebert on this and agree to disagree.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, with that, Scott, it's time to plug away. What live events do you have coming up?
Oh, Harmon, what does anybody have to plug in this crazy pandemic-filled world? I do have one thing to plug. Harmon and I do another podcast called This Is the President. We also have a YouTube channel, which you can go and watch all these videos on. As I mentioned, we just did one about Trump. Racist Woodrow Wilson and the Great Spanish Flu pandemic, and kind of what Trump's response to today's pandemic is. And we also just put up one about Jimmy Carter and his UFO experience. In light of the new UFO tapes that just came out. Yeah, so those are pretty interesting. And you can find those at our YouTube channel. It's youtube.com/ This Is the President.
Hear, hear. And what I have to plug is May 7th, next Thursday, Scott and I co-host a live streaming show called Jokioki. It's stand-up comedy, karaoke, in a 3-round game show. And yes, you can check us out on Twitch at twitch.tv/... Comedy History 101. It's that easy. So it'll be on at 7 p.m. Eastern Time next Thursday night. And be sure to like, subscribe, and comment on Comedy History 101 wherever you get it, be it Stitcher or iTunes, or even our site, comedyhistory101.com. And thanks a lot for tuning in, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Good thing about doing comedy in Russia, you have captured audience.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Comedy History 101.